This is Tango Lorca. Listen to that violin. Oh my God, this next violin part's so good. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and today's show is all about the violin. First, we're going to meet Christine Brebes, the violinist and co-founder of Tango Lorca, based here in Kansas City. They celebrated their 20th anniversary with a reunion show earlier this week. That's because Christine is back in town from Buenos Aires. Every time she comes home, all the little avant-garde clubs and hidden dance halls in town become tango venues, and the city basically throws one big long tango party until she leaves. Hi, Christine.
Hi, Gina.
How's your visit been so far?
My business has been so amazing. I got into town and I've been going to like a show a day to see friends play or rehearsing all day. So it's like, it's been so full and amazing.
You currently play the violin in the city that is the capital of tango music international, Buenos Aires. Mm-hmm. You tour internationally, and your bio on a website for tango musicians ends a long list of all these amazing credentials with a note that says you return to Kansas City whenever possible to play with your dearest and most talented friends and colleagues. That is such a compliment to Kansas City musicians. Can you talk to me about what you're saying there?
Well, I lived here in this city in my 20s, and I made the transition of going from a symphony musician and wanting to do that as my life into finding my own musical voice. And I took that first step of maturity and musical adulthood and responsibility of like getting out of the norm of things and finding my own path and playing what the music that makes me happy. And excuse me. And I started all of that with Bo.
We
started
Bo playing Bledsoe.
With Bo Bledsoe, and we started playing tango music. And then I found other friends to make the group bigger. And that was the first step that led me to where I am today, because I would not have ended up in Buenos Aires had we not started playing some tango music here.
I want to hear more about that transition that you made from someone who wanted to play in a symphony to someone who is doing a gig a night, sometimes two gigs a night, maybe even more sometimes. I mean,
I've played up to four gigs in a day.
And this is, you know, this is a very different life playing at, you know, little clubs and theaters, playing tango music in Argentina. That's not the symphony life you had imagined. And so
no.
I want to hear more about how that shift happened.
Well, the shift happened basically that I couldn't get into the Kansas City Symphony. I was not one of those cutthroat, competitive people that studied orchestra excerpts 10 hours a day to get into a symphony.
And that's what you have to do?
That's what you have to do, yeah. It's so competitive and it's so difficult, and I enjoy playing in the symphony, and I consider myself a really good orchestral musician, but I'm not a good auditioner at all. And so I didn't get in there. I ended up playing the St. Joe Symphony and waiting tables here, which a lot of people that can't get going have to do to pay their rent. So I waited tables for 2 years, And then I moved away. I moved to Lake Tahoe and lived with my cousin, and I started teaching piano and violin, and I started playing by myself in a cafe on Friday nights.
What kind of music did you play in that cafe?
Just like a lot of Chrysler, like super romantic music, a little bit of Prokofiev, a little bit of Tchaikovsky, stuff that people know, you know, meditation on a theme of Thais, and what they call encore pieces for violin. Just the more romantic it is, or if somebody wanted to hear a Beatles tune, or if somebody wanted to hear something from Fiddler on the Roof, you know, even Grease, like, of course, I'm going to play something from Grease.
When did tango enter the picture?
Well, Bo came out to visit me in Tahoe because he was saying, well, you should move back to Kansas City, because I wasn't very fulfilled doing that. But it really helped me get music back on my plate, you know, as my moneymaker and my way of living daily, just like to teach kids. And I played in the Reno Philharmonic, and then I was playing there, and he said, well, let's make a duo. I finally finished my master's.
And he is a guitarist.
He's a guitar player. And so I said, well, why don't you bring some music out and come visit me, and let's see if how it works. And so he came out, visited me, we played, and I said, you know, it's going to be cold here really soon. I'm going to go back to Kansas City. And we started... We rehearsed really hard for
a
month.
Sunny Kansas City?
Yeah. Well, it's better, like, the Sierra Nevadas, if you have a car that's breaking down all the time, and the snow is, like, triple or quadruple the snow here. So
I'll take your word for it.
So I moved back here, and we started playing with Manuel de Falla, and he started teaching me some flamenco tunes, and we hit that... That kind of Spanish habanera and we mainly played Spanish music, and which is how the name Tango Lorca came about. It's because we were very influenced. We thought that Federico García Lorca had a lot to do. He was the poet that encompassed all of the music that we were, that really spoke to us.
How did he do that? Through poetry?
Well, he used to hang out with musicians, and he also dabbled in, I think he did flamenco. He did some singing, and he also lived in Buenos Aires, and he was in the tablaos all the time with, and any composer that we were playing, his name was always in there, and it just stuck out in my head, like, oh, there's Lorca, 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 you know.
Do you remember the first time you played tango music on your violin? I mean, even if it was just sort of in your bedroom or something, you know what I mean?
We had bought a score of Astor Piazzolla's. Actually, the very first time I played a Piazzolla piece was with the Gillam Park Octet with Jeff Ruckman. He had Oblivion by Piazzolla. So it was actually before I had ever played with Bo.
Jeff Ruckman, who wrote our theme music.
Yes.
Well, so talk to me about the difference between how you play the violin for tango and how you play the violin for classical music.
The violin for tango has a lot more percussive aspects going on, and it uses it. Everything is based on classical techniques, but... they do get a lot of percussive stuff going on.
And so percussive in what way? Like, you basically, in some ways, are kind of like hitting the violin.
Yeah, there's a lot of like super marcato, super short and percussive bow hits that I'm sure get used in contemporary music, but it's not something that you hear really in classical music. You might hear it more in like Bartok or... some Stravinsky or some, you know, Schoenberg, who knows.
Tell me about when you first started. I mean, you basically started a little scene, you and Bo, here in Kansas City for a while in the 1990s. I remember moving back to Kansas City in 1999. And
that's when we were getting started with Tango Lorca. That was at the end of 99. I brought in a bandoneon player because I really, really wanted to...
What is a bandoneon?
A bandoneon is...
Which you say much better than I do.
A bandoneon is... It's like a portable pipe organ. That's what it was made in Germany to replace the organ and to take sacred music, because they were bombing each other, and they needed to have their sacred music going. Oh, my church just got destroyed. Martin could probably tell us a lot more about the bandoneon. I'm not.
You've got
really
a companion with you who we'll be hearing from shortly, playing music with you. But for now, I do want to hear more about Kansas City's tango scene in those, because for this brief time, it was surprising. Kansas City had an enthusiastic group of people who went to tango shows regularly. I remember Fedora's on the Plaza. It's not there now. But
our very first tango show, it was just Duo Lorca, and it was in the Fahrenheit Gallery. And
in the West Bottoms.
In the West Bottoms, yes. And Peregrine helped us host our very first milonga, and with my friend Elizabeth O'Keefe. She was the dance teacher, and she brought in a dance teacher from Buenos Aires, and we did a whole weekend of workshops so we could have people actually dancing at our gig.
Explain what a milonga is.
A milonga is, it's two things. It is a super fast tango, which you can dance fast to, and a milonga is also a place that you go to dance tango.
And culturally, in Argentina, what role does that fill?
The milonga... In the tango world, there are hundreds and hundreds of milongas all over Buenos Aires, and there are afternoon milongas that a lot of senior citizens go because they want to go home and sleep early, or they work at night and they need to go dance during the day. There are hippie milongas, there's super chic milongas, there are gay milongas, there's like every kind of milonga. There's milongas with live music, there's milongas that everybody has their certain DJ.
And I should say, I visited you in Argentina. We're friends. And
yes, we are.
And I visited you in Argentina and stayed with you. So I saw your life there, just how many gigs you play and how deeply embedded you are in the tango scene there. But also, I got to witness what these milongas were like, and everyone who showed up knew what to do, and there's a protocol that people follow, and
it's a code.
Yeah, it's kind of an amazing thing to witness, because I don't know of anything like it in the United States.
I've never really gone to the dance halls here, nor do I know what happened back in the 40s or 50s, as we weren't alive at that point. But there is a very ego-based thing. You know, you go in and you sit at your table, and if you're with your boyfriend, basically no guy will ask you to dance because you're with a guy. Like, no guy will look at you. So if or you go in with a group of girls, or there's women that go in by themselves. And they look at each other from across the room, and they do this tiny little like head nod or eye gesture, like, hey, let's go. And the girl can like nod and get up, and they'll meet on the dance floor, or he will walk over to her and escort her to the dance floor. Or she will look away, and he will look around for the next invitee or victim or whatever. Depends on how well or bad he dances, how you see it. But it's very much like you can look at somebody very far across the room, and that way it helps save face to a man. Like, if instead of going up and saying, hi, would you like to dance? And she says no, right to your face. And then he has to turn around, and then he's like shamed in front of everybody, you know, the whole looking across the room, and the very subtle hey, let's go over there. Look, nudge, nudge. Know what I mean? Know what I mean?
So this is part of your life now. And, you know, you were this person playing music in Kansas City with the artsy kids. You know, how did you make the leap from playing music in Kansas City to having taught yourself tango, essentially, to playing tango in the tango capital of the world? How did that happen?
On my second visit, I went in December of 2000. On my second visit, I ended up hanging out at a friend's house with Wynton Marsalis and the whole Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra. And
that
they
sounds
want,
fun.
Yeah, that was fun. And they wanted to hear some tango music. So our host hired a trio. And in that trio was a violinist. And he and the bass player of that trio were starting this tango orchestra school. They had just finished the first year of this. And so I was talking to them a lot, and I went to take a lesson with Ramiro, the violinist, and he was telling me about the tango orchestra school. So I asked them if they admitted foreigners. And he said that he didn't know because it was just getting started, but I really liked the idea of learning. It's like going to big band camp. You go and you learn with the old guys, the old masters, and they teach you like the style of their tango orchestra. So these old guys that were in their late 80s or 90s or 70s would come in with the arrangements from the orchestra and teach us in the orchestra how to play in the style of their orchestra. And so that was, I would say, at least 8 or 9 of those guys that came in that I got to play with back in 2002 and 2003, they're all passed away.
What does that generation of tango musician mean to the art form in general? I mean, why was it important to learn from them?
Because they did that 24 hours a day. They worked very differently back in the day. They had maybe like a radio show in the afternoon, and then they would go to one dance hall, and they used to do a tango orchestra for a set, and then a jazz orchestra for a set, and then a tango orchestra for a set, and then a jazz orchestra for a set. And they would do the dances, and then they would go to another one. And then they would go to an after-hours club, very similar to the Mutual Musicians Foundation, and sit around and play music until 7 o'clock in the morning.
Do you think tango is to Buenos Aires what jazz is to Kansas City? I mean, when you make that Mutual Musicians Foundation comparison.
Definitely. Definitely. I feel a lot of cultural similarities. And when I moved there, you know, the books about how Kansas City was back in the 40s and 50s, there's books like that of Argentina, how Argentina was back in the 40s and 50s. And it's very similar related, and they're both on rivers. They both have the ports, and they've got that industrial architecture of the same era. Certain things feel very similar in that aspect.
Are you surprised by how long you've been in Argentina?
Yes and no. You know, I'm surprised looking back. My original plan was to be there 2 to 5 years, and after...
It's been, what, 16?
15 years.
15.
I turned 15 April 3rd. I left here April 2nd of 2002.
And you think of that as turning 15?
I turned 15 there.
Like that was a new birthday?
Well, yeah, I turned 15 there. You know, it was my 15th Argentine birthday, so... and my kid turned 12, so... And he has green hair. It's beautiful.
You are here with your boyfriend, who's also a musician, and the two of you have a duo. You're going to play us a song in a moment, but tell me about that project.
Well, it's a very new project. We just have been dating now for 3 months, so and I've been learning his music probably for about the last month or so, and he made a really nice arrangement for Tango Lorca. So it's new, and I love playing new music. I have been very fortunate to play with a lot of new tango composers and just new Argentine composers, like that all live in Buenos Aires. And the music, I think, is really representative of what's going on there today and the new sounds. And it's not trying to sound like tango, and it's, you know, it's not danceable.
It's freeing itself from convention in a way.
It's not danceable, but somebody could definitely choreograph to it, you know, something very interesting. But it's not like something that you would go out to play in a milonga. I don't play in milongas anymore, but I do play in like some dinner clubs for extra cash. You know, it's like going to play in a jazz trio here or something.
Well, Christine and Martine are going to play a song for us. So I'll let you guys get set up and I'll describe to our listeners what's happening while you do.
Okay.
And so, yeah, and we'll let people know Christine's got a couple of shows while she's in town. And those are, let's see, she will be playing solo at Birdie's this Sunday at 4:30 with Tango Lorca May 10th at Greenwood Social Hall. And she'll be sitting in with Mr. Marcos V7 for a couple of shows as well. But now we're going to hear her duo with bandoneon player Martine Suede.
Thank you.
Was Christine Brebes on violin and Martin Suede on bandoneon and doing whistling. Thank you guys so much. It was amazing to hear that. And we've been hearing from Christine Brebes, who founded Tango Lorca in Kansas City in 1999. She's got shows in Kansas City. We'll have the information about those with the web post for the show after we get out of here. Up next, the jazz violin, or is it the jazz fiddle? I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and Adam Goldblum. Good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
Adam is a jazz fiddler with Hot Club KC. And Adam, what is a hot club?
A hot club. So back in the 1930s, there was a guitarist named Django Reinhardt in France, and he came from the Gypsy people, and he was just a brilliant guitar player who teamed up with the violinist Stefan Grappelli, and the two of them basically interpreted American jazz for their time and place, and their band was called the Hot Club of France. So the music was so impactful that it essentially spawned a number of hot clubs around the country. You got the Hot Club of San Francisco, the Hot Club of Tokyo, say, and we're Hot Club KC.
So I want to hear a little bit of your group's sound. This is Hot Club KC performing Viper's Dream. That is, so we're listening to Hot Club KC performing Viper's Dream, and Adam, you're plucking your violin along to the music. tell me about what we're hearing. It's very dancey. Not all jazz is.
It's true. I like to think of the style of music as like a blend between folk music and jazz. It's jazzy. It's got jazzy elements, harmonies, rhythms. But the instruments, the acoustic string instruments, the violins, the guitars, it doesn't get too out there and, you know, complicated. And so it's got folk music elements. You can tap your foot to it for sure. It's not difficult to listen to.
Why did you start this group? I mean, was this a kind of music or an approach to entertainment that you thought was missing in Kansas City?
There's a niche. There's a community of swing jazz here that's incredible, and we fit into that community quite well. But there was a little bit of a niche, and you know, for me personally, it's just a matter of the violin. It doesn't really exist in jazz all that much, and I love playing the violin with traditional jazz groups that have drums and electric guitars and keys and everything. But the truth is that the violin just fits so well in this ensemble, in this genre. And I have experience with it. I have background with it, playing this kind of music. It comes pretty naturally to me. And fortunately, I've got the guys here in town that are willing and able to be part of this group. And it's just been a blast. We've been rehearsing every week for, gosh, it's been maybe a year. We've rehearsed every week, and we've just put a really good project together.
You call yourself a jazz fiddler rather than a jazz violinist, and I'm curious about that choice.
Well, it's funny. I use both terms. That might have come from my website, which I probably should update. I've been using violin more lately, but they're the same. It's the same instrument. It's a very common question, and the answer is very simple. It's the same instrument. You know, it's a vernacular thing. I tell people that I often hear classical, you know, accomplished class. I heard Yitzhak Perlman refer to his violin as his fiddle. And then, you know, country fiddlers will talk about their violin. So, yes, it's how you play it, but they are the same instrument. And I just, the words are interchangeable. It's like a nickname.
So tell me about your background. You apprenticed with Claude Fiddler Williams, which is incredible. How did that come about?
It's totally incredible. And it's kind of a funny story. You know, growing up, I had a musical childhood. My mother's side had music in it. My grandmother was a pianist who taught her through her whole life, went to Juilliard. But my family wasn't particularly versed in jazz music. That just didn't exist. When I decided to go to Berklee College of Music to explore improvisation, I was fortunate enough to be able to go, and the first thing that happened when I got there was I spoke to, I had my first lesson with Matt Glazer, the great pedagogue there, and his first question to me was, oh, you're from Kansas City, you must know Claude Fiddler Williams. And I was like, yeah, you know, I think I've heard that name. So Matt said to me, well, your first assignment is to, you know, over winter break, go home and find Claude. And I did, and it absolutely changed my life.
How did you find him? I mean, you're just this kid being told to find this guy.
Right. I don't remember how I found him. I found his phone number, I guess.
Wow. So you didn't go to a gig. You called him up?
Maybe I went to it. I don't remember.
Oh, okay.
I really don't remember how I found him. But I do remember being at his house a lot. I have a stack of cassette tapes of the recorded lessons that we did. And it was amazing. I mean, you know, there's these like stories about, you know, if you read, like, for example, Zen Buddhist literature, there's kind of like this apocryphal story where like when the student is ready, the master, all he has to do is touch the student and the student is instantly enlightened. And these, it felt like that. Like Claude took my violin and played a note on it, like just one note. And it was stunning. It turned me upside down. I couldn't believe you could make a violin sound like that. I didn't know that this kind of thing existed. And so that, I kept coming back. And we didn't do a whole lot of talking. I mean, we talked. You know, he told me some stories. But he would just play things, and I would play him right back. And it was beautiful. It was a really great experience.
What was it about him that made you, want to invest this kind of time and energy in this one-on-one training when you also had the option of getting your training at Berklee School of Music.
Oh my gosh, he was, he was the real deal. Just absolutely the real deal. And I'm so fortunate to have been able to have the experience with him. He came from a place, you know, he was bunk mates with Lester Young. If you go back and listen to the earliest recordings of Charlie Parker with Jay McShann, you know, Claude's playing the head on Honeysuckle Rose, and then Bird comes in and takes a solo. So, I mean, Claude was there. He was, you know, Count Basie's guitar player. Claude was the guitar player for Count Basie's band. And the two of them were close friends, you know, Basie and Claude. So he's the real deal. I mean, I'm just a suburban Kansas kid who, you know, was lucky enough his parents made him take music lessons. But Claude was the real deal. He was there for the real thing. And there aren't many jazz violin players anyway, let alone ones just from the earth like Claude was. And I knew what an important thing it was when lucky I was to be there with him.
What happened after that apprenticeship?
Well, you know, the details are fuzzy, but the overarching, for me anyway, is I'm a pretty curious person, and I'm interested in lots of different things and lots of different kinds of music. I went exploring. You know, I went exploring to different places, crashed on a lot of couches, got some students, went out and, you know, met some musicians, got some gigs, got some students in different places. I ended up in Denver, Colorado, playing bluegrass and bluegrass-derived music. Was there for almost 10 years before coming back to Kansas City just about 2.5 years ago.
You've got your violin on a chair just right next to you now, and I'd love it. Would you be able to demonstrate for us the difference between what this instrument sounds like when it's used for jazz and what the instrument sounds like when it's used for bluegrass?
Yeah, it's a great question. Honestly, Gina, no one has ever asked me to do that before. I have never had this. It's a great question. I'm happy to give it my best shot. It's a lot of it is how you play it, because like I said, it's the same instrument. So for example, if you're playing something in jazz, it sounds a little more like a classical violin, but without some of the single notes, smooth execution, vibrato, obviously the rhythms, the more swingy kind of thing, and then the harmony, you know, of course, is going to be a lot more involved with jazz than with bluegrass.
You say of course, but I'm not sure that's an of course to me.
Well, it might be after you hear the bluegrass.
Okay. Yeah, let's hear the bluegrass.
So something like with bluegrass sounds more like this.
Describe that difference.
Well, I mean, the obvious things are with the bluegrass fiddle, you're playing double stops, which is, in violin parlance, double stops is two notes at once. In jazz violin, you can definitely get away with playing double stops. It's a little trickier. And honestly, I tend to think of the violin more like a saxophone in jazz. And so, you know,
as in it's vocal?
Yep. And it's one note at a time. You don't play two notes at a time. right? You play one. I don't know if you can hear that. That's two.
Yeah.
Notes, that is two notes at a time. That's called a double stop in the violin. So the bluegrass fiddle, you know, it's just the rhythms are different. It's a lot of double stops, and frankly, just the vocabulary and the parlance is different. There's different expressions, simpler harmonies. You get the idea.
We'll continue our conversation with jazz fiddler Adam Goldblum when KCUR's Central Standard returns. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. Adam Goldblum of Hot Club KC, welcome back to Central Standard.
Hi, Gina.
So we have been talking about your career, which involved apprenticing with Claude Fiddler Williams. It includes the jazz violin, bluegrass fiddle, and you've recently moved back to Kansas City. What are your thoughts about the Kansas City jazz scene after a long hiatus?
My Lord, I could not be happier. I am inspired every day by so many musicians here, and it's that really says it all. It's just great. I mean, you know, maybe we could use a few more places to play, maybe, but, you know, it's just amazing. The musicians are incredible.
So, Adam, you're about to play a song for us. We've got just a couple minutes for that. What's the song going to be?
Well, this is a tune that I recently worked on for an event that Claude Williams' wife was at. And she came back to Kansas City for a minute, and there was an event at the American Jazz Museum, and I was very... honored to be asked to come play a little bit. And so I worked up this tune that Claude used to play a lot. It was one of his signature tunes. It's called These Foolish Things. I'm going to start it with a introduction that Claude always played on this tune.
Okay, so Adam's going to go to the better place to play music in this studio. He's setting up, and here he's ready to go. That's Adam Goldblum of Hot Club KC. Hot Club KC is performing tonight at the Corvino Supper Club. And now, Gracie Schramm has been singing and writing songs since she was a little girl in Leawood. Her music's often driven by her conscience, but the new song, Under the Sun, has particular resonance. It won first place in a local songwriting competition called the 7 Days Campaign, commemorating victims of the shooting at the Jewish Community Center in Overland Park 3 years ago.
I think the whole situation with the Jewish Community Center was really devastating. And then to find out that the guy was just such an evil person, I think that made it really hard, too.
For our Story of a Song series, here's Gracie Schramm with Under the Sun.
I think for me, I'm trying to change the world through the power of music. And so I just want to put out music that spreads light and spreads truth and authenticity and just makes people smile and puts out a positive vibe into the world. If you look at what's happening in the world right now, that's really what we need.
Every single heartbeat, every breath that we breathe, you're like me. Like a wider outcast, it doesn't even matter. We need to stop trying to find a way to disagree. We're all just the same, but a little bit different.
I have strong views on a lot of different things, but I'm not political, really, at all. I observed the differences, even on a college campus, with, like, the election and having it be my first time to vote and all of the things that kind of came into play with that, where people are like, oh, you voted for this person? Now I hate you. Like, it's just, it got so polarized.
No matter where we come from, we all need to give love, and it's time to stop trying to find a way to disagree.
And I feel like sometimes it's just silly because we're dividing over things that do matter, but in the way that we're having those conversations, it's not something that's constructive. All it's doing is making us divide farther and farther apart. I just think people need to have a greater understanding for the other side and what other people think so that we can have a real conversation as opposed to just a yelling match.
World keeps spinning on around, around again. I'm tired of all the fighting, I just want you to be my friend. We're all just the same, but a little bit different, and different's the beautiful part.
At the heart of it, like, we all want to be loved, and we all want to have a life of meaning and leave a legacy and make an impact in the world, and I think that's why we need to be kind and why we need to be loving and accepting of other people so that they can go out there and pursue their dream, whatever that is.
One, together as one, together as one. I'm tired of all the fighting, I just want you to be.
You can hear Gracie Schramm at the middle of the Matt Fest. She'll also be singing the national anthem for the Royals and Sporting KC this summer. This story of a song was produced by KCUR's Suzanne Hogan. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Todd Hope, and Suzanne Hogan. Caitlin Troutman is our intern. Linda Scher runs the board for us. And our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman.